HQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina. This is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Randy Sturgill grew up in the living quarters of the Harnett County Jail, but not because he broke any laws. His father was the chief deputy sheriff, and the Sturgill family lived on the grounds of the jailhouse. It was the prisoners that taught Randy how to play cards and also lectured him about living a better life than the ones they had chosen. It's worth noting that Harnett County is mostly land and very little water, but the Cape Fear River runs through it, and Randy Sturgill remembers playing near its banks as a child. He also remembers the family's regular trips to North Carolina's coast, where he played at the beach. Those were the touchstones of his childhood. Although they didn't come into play in his professional life until more than half a century later. He followed his father into law enforcement, starting as a cadet at the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C., then moving back to North Carolina to serve in communications for Highway Patrol. A couple of years later, he became a Lillington police officer in Harnett County. Eventually, he joined the Harnett County Sheriff's Office, where he worked as a uniformed deputy and narcotics investigator. But you might recognize the name Randy Sturgill for a different reason: local news headlines. He's often credited with mobilizing the grassroots movement against offshore drilling and seismic testing, causing hundreds of municipalities along the eastern seaboard to sign resolutions opposing oil and gas exploration offshore. Today, he works as a senior field representative for Oceana, a national nonprofit conservation organization that works to influence policy for the preservation and restoration of the world's oceans. His path to environmental advocacy, as a group of four wise men once said, has been a long and winding road. We'll take a trip with him on that road today. Randy Sturgill, what a pleasure it is to welcome you to Coastline.
Well, thank you so much, Rachel. It is a pleasure to be here today. And don't really see what the real kick is about my life, but I'll be more than willing to share it with you.
Well, thank you for that. Let's start with growing up in the living quarters of the Harnett County Jail. I mean, most people have never even heard of the idea of living on the same grounds as prisoners in a jail. How did that come about?
Well, in 1958, Wade Stewart was elected sheriff of Harnett County, and he chose his staff, and he chose my father to be the chief deputy and jailer. And at that time, you'll have to put on your Mayberry thinking cap here and go back in time, but there was not 24-hour law enforcement. There was, in the county setting, there were deputies that worked from 8 to 5, and anything that happened after that time, they got a phone call from someone, and that someone happened to be my father. And it was, we moved into the jailhouse, if you can imagine, a two-story brick home with the back door connected to a jailhouse. And that's pretty much how it was. And
your mom cooked the meals for the prisoners?
She was what was known as a matron of the jail, and she was there also if women prisoners were incarcerated there. And she would be the contact for them. And the meals were breakfast, lunch, and dinner, just like in any household, but she cooked a bit more depending on how many prisoners were in there, and they ate the same things that that we did. And
so she shared family dinner, basically.
Absolutely. It was like they didn't sit at the same table, but they had the very same meal. And she always got kudos from the exiting prisoners. You know, everything was really bad except the food.
And you actually would spend time with these guys You say they taught you to play cards? Did your parents ever worry about what kind of influence these guys might be having on you as a kid?
Well, it was almost like even the prisoners that were in there, some of them you actually knew from being in the neighborhood. I mean, anywhere from murder to robbery to whatever, but generally the tougher guys were kept in separate cells. But there was a large area, actually two areas, and that had like eight bunks per area and a little dining area and that type thing. And the bars went all the way to the floor. So the ones that I knew and was allowed to be within bars distance from, we just sat on the floor there and played cards and, again, gave me a direction on life of what not to do to be on the other side of those bars.
Was there one particular prisoner, person, who really made an impression on you that you think about to this day?
I think so. I'd rather not mention any names.
Sure.
But he was actually an employee of the town, and he actually knew the person that he murdered. And it was just, hearing his life story that you would normally, that I would have probably never heard, and just how senseless he thought what he did. It was like that there was total remorse. And so I guess that one individual would probably stand out.
Do you think that your contact with those guys helped humanize them in a way? I mean, you went on to have this career in law enforcement, and we'll talk a little bit later about some of the impressions you have from that career and some of the images that stick with you and what was tough for you. But do you think this early contact with these guys shape help propel you into law enforcement?
Well, again, it's like a kid growing up on a farm and the likelihood of them becoming a farmer just as their father. Here I was with my dad. My entire life was in law enforcement. My brother had left Harnett County, went to Washington, D.C., and worked in the photo lab and the FBI. So it was like it was the direction with an unknown gravity pull to that, I can't explain. But, I know later on, and compassion, even for the not-so-good doers that I had, and maybe when there was an opportunity, even working in drugs, to get someone involved in some type of rehabilitation versus going down the criminal justice route when it was a borderline thing, I guess would be one of the things that if it wasn't some really heinous crime, that a second chance is so deserving for so many.
Yeah, which is interesting. Do you think, Randy Sturgill, that there are evil people or just bad choices? Or is it kind of a mix? I mean, did you ever encounter someone that you thought was just evil to the bone and not savable?
I think so. I thought for so long that it was just bad choices. And still with so many people, it's bad choices. But I honestly believe there's some that the evil is to the bone. And I'm not the one that could explain how that could happen. But, it's just what I feel.
Yeah. And you mentioned your brother, Jack, who also lives in North Carolina now, there's a pretty substantial age gap there. So when you were growing up, it wasn't really like growing up with a playmate, was it?
No, it was like I had this big brother. And you know, when you're like five and a kid that is 12 years older, I mean, they're like big people. So and I was so proud growing up of my brother. And so a lifeguard at the Dunn Pool and co-captain of the Dunn basketball team. And so, you know, I had a lot of little brother pride. But, you know, it was more like having a cousin versus it being a brother. So,
yeah. And you grew up playing on near the Cape Fear River. What do you remember about the Cape Fear River in Harnett County? What drew you to it?
Well, I mean, it was there. We had to cross it. It was like a half a mile from home, and so many things. The phrase was, "We're going across the river," which means you were just, you know, going across the river. But to go to like Buies Creek, Irwin, Dunn, you cross the river, and those were some of the areas people would go to. And a lot of fond memories there.
You're listening to Coastline. Randy Sturgill, North Carolinian, born and bred, an environmental advocate for Oceana, is my guest today. We'll have more with him after this short break. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Randy Sturgill launched a grassroots movement to oppose offshore drilling and seismic testing off the coast of North Carolina, and that movement spread up and down the eastern seaboard, with hundreds of municipalities joining to oppose those activities. But Sturgill didn't come at environmental advocacy in any sort of linear way. He retired from a career in law enforcement before he ever considered the next professional chapter. And Randy Sturgill, just before we went to break, you were talking about growing up in Harnett County. The Cape Fear River was really the body of water there. What do you remember about the river? What kinds of critters would you see there regularly? What drew you to the river?
Well, again, like I said before, you know, it was there. It was, and for kids, you know, it was a natural draw to the mystique of rivers. And so, you know, going down to the river with friends, you know, it was never somewhere where you went alone. You know, you had your buddies to go with. And, you know, all up and down, in all of this mostly took place within the city limits of Lillington, but, you know, still in wooded areas off on the riverbanks. And critters, you know, water moccasin comes to mind, and water moccasin, and water moccasin, and water moccasin. There were tons of water moccasin on this river. From the bank, you would see water moccasin. From hanging from the low-hanging branches in the river, you would see water moccasin. And probably one of the most stunning times remembering seeing these snakes was like being up on the walking portion, the side portion of the Cape Fear River Bridge there, and looking down and seeing the number of them swimming near the banks, but swimming. You know, you could like sit there and count like 10 or 15 at a time. And so that was probably an image that is stuck with me. And but you know, other animals you would see, bobcat, you would see turtles. And then later on in our teens, I guess the key reason is being down on the river with your buddies fishing all night, trying to catch that biggest catfish. And
so, what do you think the biggest catfish is that you ever caught from the Cape Fear River?
God, maybe 5 pounds. I mean, it was none of the monsters that I have seen other people catch there. You know, it was like, and that was more of a catch and release. You know, I didn't know what to do with it once I caught it, so let's put it back and we'll catch him again. So, but using chicken parts as bait and just a little bit different fishing than down here in some good old salt water.
Did you ever eat any of the fish that you caught from the Cape Fear River, or was that not something that you would do? Was it considered a clean river when you were growing up?
Well, I mean, who knows? I mean, you know, the testing that goes on in the river today was nowhere near what it is today. So, you know, you don't know. I mean, I've always known it to be a muddy river. So up at home, it always had this brown, reddish-brown tint to it. And but I never ate any of the catfish that I know of that came out of the river. And very, very few freshwater fish did we eat. We were kind of a flounder, black bass type of family, and shrimp, oysters. So really not that much on eating the local freshwater fish.
Your parents would take you to the beach. You had to drive from Harnett County, which isn't quite halfway inland in North Carolina, but it's well inland. How long did it take you to get to the beach? Which beaches did you visit? Which ones were your favorite?
Yeah, the first and the really the only beaches as far as staying overnight that I remember up until, gosh, into my late teens was Holden Beach. There were some other folks that were friends of my dad's that had one of the old flat-top, tar-roofed, 1960 vintage cottages down on about halfway down Holden Beach. And Dad would rent it from them from time to time. And so my love for the coast was hatched right there on Holden Beach.
So that's interesting, because that really was a different era when working class, middle class folks had an easier time vacationing beachfront. It's, you know, more and more we're watching it become something for the very affluent or ultra rich. But do you remember other families, working class families on the beach?
I do. And again, getting on up into my teens, you know, I remember so many families just from, you know, a 10-mile circumference of Lillington that owned beach homes there. And, you know, these were John Q. citizens. You know, they were middle-class, working, hard-working, farming families that just had this, with no air conditioner, sometimes the screens would be intact to keep those no-see-ums out, and no phone, no television, but there was a beautiful sight off that front porch and out over the, and you know, I just remember the dunes being so big at that time. You know, whether they were really big or I was just really small, I mean, but you know, I do remember that, and I remember my dad pointing out to my mom as we were riding down the beach, well, see, this house was one that is still torn down from Hazel. And so, you know, Hazel, you know, in the early 60s was still fresh in the minds of a lot of people. And, you know, you, at that time you could go, you know, 3/4 of a mile down the beach and there'd not be another cottage. And,
yeah.
And the prices back during the 40s, I can't remember what they were, but they were like, wow, don't we all wish we had bought up like, you know, a mile of beach back then. And, but I do remember that the swing bridge and, the couple of places you could put in your boat. And it was just all about, more like fishing beach than, a Myrtle Beach.
You're listening to Coastline. My guest today is Randy Sturgill, North Carolinian born and bred, retired law enforcement officer from Harnett County, and now a senior field representative for the national nonprofit Oceana. Sturgill launched the grassroots movement in 2014 to oppose oil and gas exploration off the North Carolina coast. That was a movement that quickly spread up and down the eastern seaboard when hundreds of municipalities signed on to a resolution opposing those activities in the Atlantic. And Randy Sturgill, part of what is so compelling about your personal story is the fact that you spent so much of your adult life in some form of law enforcement. So you started as part of the Metropolitan Police in Washington, D.C., came back to North Carolina, served in communications for Highway Patrol, then became a Lillington police officer. And then you joined the Harnett County Sheriff's Office. Tell us what you did for Harnett County.
Well, for a year, I actually worked uniform as serving warrants and civil process and actually some court bailiff duties. And but for several years with the department, I worked in drug investigations and was actually one of the first two drug agents for the county. And at that time, we worked in a group of three counties. And it was Cumberland, Harnett, and Sampson County in a drug task force, and partially federal funded, the best I remember. And worked undercover and just pretty much Chapter 90 of the North Carolina General Statutes.
Now, you've told me that there are elements of that part of your career that really stick with you. And there were parts of just being in law enforcement that were difficult for you. What do you remember that is with you today that was maybe more difficult to process than you understood at the time? I mean, there's a particular story you have about a crime scene that sticks with you more than the others.
Yeah, and you know, like we had discussed as well, you know, law enforcement is something that you're going from like 5 mile an hour to 100 mile an hour in a split second. You're going from a rested heartbeat to your heart beating out of your chest, and it comes many times without warning. And One situation that comes to mind was I was on a going with an SBI agent up to Winston-Salem on an interview. I'm going to make this as short as possible. You know I can surely draw things out. We were going up there, and we ended up like in third line in a police chase. And we were going north, couldn't remember the road out of Greensboro. And we turned on, and as we were in this chase, I could see a arm hanging out of the driver's side of this SUV we were chasing. And you could see little flashes and little smoke puffs. So, you know, I said, uh-oh, you know, we're being shot at. So me in the passenger seat, I kind of slid down to about eye level of the dash. And so finally we turn onto this state-maintained two-lane road, cross the railroad track, and all of a sudden this vehicle exploded. And we take cover behind the car, not knowing really what's going on at that time, and we finally work our way up, and there's a deceased lady there in the road. Someone yells that, and this is like, wow, say 50 yards from where the vehicle exploded. Someone said that there's a guy over here, so we go over there, and he is on his last breath. And he passes away there. It, you know, almost looks like every bone is broken in his body from this explosion. But then the part, I guess, it sticks with me the most, you know, like if this is not enough, we're over to the SUV where the top has blown completely off of it. It had like a fiberglass top. I can't remember if this was a like a Chevrolet product or a Ford, but back then they had one that had this fiberglass top. Well, anyway, it disintegrated, and there were two youngsters dressed in camouflage, and they were laying down low in the vehicle, and both were dead. And this guy was part of some type extremist something organization and was wanted for murder up in Kentucky. And so that's one example that would stick with me. And as you know, no talking the other day, I have two or three more, but again, that's one for sure, Rachel.
Yeah, and your life sounds like it's so different from that today. Did you ever need to, I mean, I don't know as a civilian how I would process something like that, how I could ever live with those images in my head. Did you ever suffer from some form of PTSD, or I mean, how do you deal with that?
I don't know. You know, I know that there were different cases and different types of law enforcement I knew from day one I would not be a fit for. And that would be working child abuse cases, spousal abuse cases, because I don't think I would be the fair investigating officer. I think my emotions would outweigh. So I stayed away from those things. And there were times you would come home and be eating dinner across from your family, and you're saying, you know, some of the things that happened at work today, you know, there's a good chance I should not even be here eating tonight. And it does weigh on you. But, you know, seeing death, I think, is much like, and you know, maybe not to the extent of an undertaker, but you know, it's like some of it just it goes past, but then you have some that stick. And
you think back now And I guess back at the time when you were active in law enforcement, maybe there was some suspension of that understanding that you were really at risk. And then later you've said that you look back and you think, ooh, my life was really at risk in that particular situation. Do you still think about that today?
I do. And you know, I think about, I look at the young folks and not so young folks that are still in law enforcement. And, you know, I go back in time and I think, and, you know, of course I was a puppy then, you know, I was bulletproof, or at least thought I was. As I grew older, you know, it was like, wow, I just don't think if it was me starting off again today, I would have probably chosen a different career field. But, you know, thank God for the folks that are choosing this career field, because we certainly do need them out there today.
Yeah, and we are going to go to break in less than a minute, but you raise an interesting point. I've heard from at least one current member of law enforcement that he feels like he has a target on his back, just because of some of the conversations that have unfolded around race in this country. Is that something that was markedly different during the time that you were in law enforcement? When you hear those conversations now, when you see the George Floyd video, how do you process that as a former officer?
Well, as the video itself and that specific case, you know, it was uncalled for. I mean, you know, that I just can't see that happening back during my day. But again, there are other cases that, you know, I could go on and on about this.
Yeah. You're listening to Coastline. My guest today is Randy Sturgill, retired law enforcement officer, annual Santa Claus impersonator, and environmental advocate. We'll be right back after this short break. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Randy Sturgill was born close to the middle of North Carolina, well inland, where the only large body of water was the Cape Fear River. But his family frequently traveled to Brunswick County beaches, deeply embedding Sturgill's love of nature and the ocean. Today, this retired law enforcement officer works as a senior field representative for the national nonprofit Oceana, which works to influence policy that will restore and preserve the world's oceans. And Randy Sturgill, this is a big, complicated topic, and we could certainly devote an entire hour to it. We won't, because we want to get to your work as an environmental advocate, which seems like such a left turn from the years you spent in law enforcement. But I was asking you before we went to break about the conversation today about racism in America, the role of law enforcement, how different it was when you were growing up and when you were in that profession yourself. What are some of the things that you saw in Harnett County?
Well, again, you know, we're going back to the early and mid 60s, and the racial unrest across the country, across our state, and into counties across the state. And Harnett County was not shielded from any of this either. And
you saw active Ku Klux Klan activity.
I did. Not only in parades, when parade permits were issued, but the cross burnings in people's yards, organized Klan
rallies,
mm-hmm. and where they would have these massive crosses and burning them. And so, you know, it was pretty commonplace to see these type of actions back during that time, in the signs of racism, even in the courthouse with the dual water fountains, the different bathrooms, and in some eating establishments. I remember the Lillington Theater, African Americans had to go upstairs during that period of time, and in the balcony.
Do you remember thinking that there was something wrong with that as a kid, or were you so steeped in the white supremacist culture at that point that that's just how it was in your mind?
I think if I were just making my choice or making my life around what I saw, you know, gosh, you know, maybe I could have been sucked into this. But, you know, fortunately with my parents and my dad fighting for equal rights for everyone, it I was going to stick with my dad on this one and not let any type of influences from the public influence where I stood on this issue. So it's always been something of interest to me. Even, you know, when we were discussing when I went to Washington, D.C. as a police cadet, during those periods in late 71, you know, there was still the burnout buildings throughout Washington, boarded up from the riots. So, you know, so much of that time, you know, still in the old memory banks here.
Yeah, and you eventually retired and then decided you weren't done working. You moved to the coast with your wife, and this is your high school sweetheart, but she's not the woman you had children with.
That's correct. Out of high school, when left high school, my high school sweetheart, Vicki Holland, we went our separate ways. And had two beautiful daughters with my first wife.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was working as an investigator with the state, with DMV, ran into Vicki's mother at Sears on one of my lunch breaks. I always like to go by and look at the Craftsman tools. And so ran into her. I let her know that I was divorced, and then she mentioned that Vicki was either separated or divorced, I can't remember which. So automatically, as we're walking away, bells start dinging in my head like, you know, maybe I should call her. So I finally, after 2 weeks, got the nerve up to call her, ask her to go out to lunch. We went out to lunch, and here it is 23 years later. It's all history. It's like when we... After a 25, you know, we joke about like the Eagles taking a break. We took a 25-year break too, and so we.
And your kids were about the same age.
Yeah,
you had two
yeah.
daughters. She had two sons.
Right, right.
It's the story.
Yep.
Okay, so we're not going to go there, but then so you retire, you move to the coast. You've always loved the beach. You get into environmental advocacy, and 2014 comes along, and this controversial issue explodes because suddenly The Mid-Atlantic region, which includes the waters off the North Carolina coast, is going to be opened up for offshore drilling and seismic testing. And you launched this grassroots campaign. How did that happen?
Well, now, I would love to take full credit for launching all of this, but this was like this song, with a little help from my friends. This was a coalition of not only many local and statewide, national environmental groups too. Many of these had issues more broad than just the ocean. So, you know, it was like myself and maybe one or two more were primarily working on this issue. And so we found out if we could all get together and speak as one and not be duplicating a lot of efforts, that we could get a lot done. We did that, and it has been a match made in heaven, and it has really worked. And but the key to this battle, and you know, I coined the phrase like the battle of the Atlantic, as it was in World War II, but this is the battle for the Atlantic, and we were fighting to, you know, not to cause a lot of trouble or heartache, you know, just leave us alone. You know, you don't need this oil. So, but educating the public was a key. Getting people involved, taking John Q. Citizen, and that just didn't have a clue that the oil industry was in hot pursuit of their water here. And as far as a persuasion conversation with these people, I mean, you know, just a couple of minutes, and, you know, the only thing they were looking for is the truth. And right. So, but being able to again, fact-based, the truth, here it is, and be able to be in a position to fact-check what was being thrown at them was key. So, again,
Well, let's talk for a second about that particular battle, because we've had some back and forth on that. It seemed like the folks who opposed offshore drilling and seismic testing essentially won the battle, and the Mid-Atlantic became a protected area where there wasn't going to be any kind of drilling, and then suddenly all bets were off and it was open again. Where are we now? Is there a battle right now to protect the waters off the North Carolina coast against seismic drilling and offshore oil and gas exploration?
Well, I think right now we're looking into the future for the actions we're looking at right now. And what we're looking for are permanent protections. As we saw the battle during the Obama administration of getting the Atlantic pulled from a plan, from the 5-year plan to drill in the Atlantic. The seismic battles were won not only in courts, but the calendar running out and the industry not moving forward to renew those. The President Trump comes in, all bets are off. All the work we had done during that time, it's like, you know, his administration wanted to open up like 90% of U.S. waters or better to offshore exploration. So we were in a situation to where we had to, again, the citizens standing up, fighting. And then late in his administration, he comes in and does a 10-year moratorium on North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida that goes into effect July 1st of 2020. 2022.
So that moratorium begins 2022. That's a 10-year moratorium. So before 2032, you would like to see permanent protections put in. Is that sort of where we are? Like, it's not going to be happening in the next 10 years.
Well, again, we're at one of those spots. It depends on which legal interpretation you look at here. But, you know, there would be a possibility that a president could override this. It's my understanding that that President Biden does not want to set a precedent by doing that. So, again, if we had permanent protections in line from the Congress, signed by the president, to be able to undo those, another president coming in just saying, I want to drill, baby, drill, it can't happen without congressional actions taking place, just as we would hope it would happen with these permanent protections.
You have three other areas of focus in your environmental advocacy, protecting North Atlantic right whales, the issue with ocean plastic, that pollution crisis, and also trying to do away with the shark fin trade. The North Atlantic right whales, we know that's a critically endangered animal. And there was a report recently put out by Oceana talking about the risks that these North Atlantic right whales face. So much of what hurts this population are vessel strikes. And it looked from that report as though Wilmington, North Carolina was an area where these vessels are not abiding by agreements on speed and are putting these animals at greater risk of vessel strikes. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, that's true. And when the report came out, this was, again, like to most people, it was news to me. And again, seeing Wilmington in the first line of that, and then in the area between Wilmington and Brunswick, Georgia, kind of saddened me a bit, knowing, you know, it's on my home turf here. And, you know, hopefully, again, we can cause enough concern with NOAA to work on this issue. And
can you just help us understand what is actually happening? You're saying that these vessels are speeding into the port near Wilmington. How is this happening?
You mean how do we know they're speeding?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, we have satellite imagery that we use that is mostly used to monitor fishing vessels going into illegal fishing areas, and using the same models on time, distance. They're able to calculate the speeds during those and able to indicate that, you know, the speeding is taking place there by those vehicles.
And, of course, we're going to put all of these issues into the show notes with this episode of Coastline. And we are just about coming to the end of our time. But, Randy Sturgill, if people wanted to meet Santa Claus and Mrs. Claus in person, how can they do that?
Well, if we haven't really got that far into it, but we have Vicki and I both. She is Mrs. Claus and I am Santa Claus. A few years ago, we did this for some friends up in Pender County, and then a few years later decided to buy our own Santa suits and Ms. Claus suits and get out and spread the joy during Christmas, during COVID, blowing our horn, waving from the car.
Okay. Well, that's this edition of Coastline. Randy Sturgill, thank you so much for sharing your life with us today.
Thank you, Rachel. It's been fun.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org or find the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.